he was into writing the very best music that his talent and training and circumstances could allow. During his day, that is the late 15th century into the 16th century, instrumental music was not highly developed. We didn't have the organs that we have now. The stringed instruments were quite primitive compared to what they are now. And these instruments didn't offer a lot of flexibility, color, and variety to composers. The instruments were for popular music, for dance music, but the very best, highest, most expensive music, that which the church bought and paid for, was all for voices. That's a very important thing in terms of what I want to talk about today, because just the time when the Lutheran Church was being founded, the voice was king, and choral music was king. The very most talented people were writing music for voices, for choirs primarily, not for soloists, for choirs, to be sung in church. Josquin's works, which number in the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, are divided into three groups. The first is masses. We did the mass last night, you know, the Kyrie, the Gloria, and so forth and so on. The Lutherans do the mass every Sunday if they have they have communion. Motets, which are the music that we did during communion last night. You would call that motets. Only we did something called chorales, but that's the motets section. And then some secular music, secular songs, but which were written with the same care and artistry as his church music. Josquin, as I said, left where he came from, the Netherlands area, and went down to Italy as a singer in the papal chapel choir and for the Duke of Ferrara, and he graduated from being a singer to being a composer. He learned his craft working for other composers and other conductors, and eventually went back home to northern France, where he died in 1521. He's important to us because Luther knew about him. Probably every educated person in Western Europe knew about Josquin. He was very important, but Luther knew about him and wrote about him. And anytime you read anything about Josquin, you read what Luther said about him. And I quote, "Luther called him the master of the notes, which must do as he wishes. Other composers must do as the notes wish." Well, this is a very insightful comment on Luther's part, and says as much about Luther as it does about Josquin. Luther was himself a very fine musician. He was well trained. He wasn't a musician professionally. He was a reformer, a priest, and ultimately a husband and father professionally. But he was a fine musician, and in founding a new church, he put his stamp on the kind of music this new church was going to do. That's, I guess, what this long story is about. There were other reformers who started other Protestant groups who didn't have Luther's love of music and Luther's sophistication and Luther's talent musically. And so, as far as music history goes, they are sidelines. They sort of go off on the side, and they have interesting music for people to study and write dissertations about. But the Lutherans have got Bach. The Lutherans have got Schütz. The Lutherans have got Buxtehude. The Lutherans have got Brahms. He called himself an agnostic, but his background was Lutheran. The Lutherans have got Mendelssohn, who converted from Judaism to Lutheranism. The Lutherans had Schütz, and I mentioned him, Scheidt and Schein, other early Baroque composers. The Lutherans in the 20th century have Distler. We've got an incredible tradition of what we call art music in the Lutheran Church. I passed out, and we'll get to some things in here in a little while, but I was going through the list of composers in the back. The Lutheran hymnal has a lot of hymns by world-class composers. you should know that most hymnals don't. Most hymnals have hymns that were written for devotional and evangelical purposes by pastors, missionaries, so forth. The Lutherans have a whole column listing in the back of things by Bach. We're really, really very fortunate in our tradition that that Luther lined us up on that side. I think it's important to establish this right off because the Lutherans have a little bit more of a problem, therefore, in dealing with the modern world than some other denominations have. In other denominations, other Protestant denominations, I'm generalizing horribly here. I hope you'll forgive that. We've only got an hour and we want to cover a lot of stuff. Something that the Lutherans did as well, but that everybody does, is they kind of take popular music and they put sacred words to it. And then this is familiar to the congregation, the parish who is singing. They can recognize the melodies. If they have to read them, they can read them easily, but chances are they don't even have to read them because they can learn them by rote or they already are familiar with the specific melodies. They learn new words, and that makes up their worship music. If you go back to the Roman Catholic tradition, it was entirely different. The Roman Catholic Church, up to the time of the Reformation, was the single most powerful and wealthiest institution in all of Western Europe. They had the money, the prestige, all the power that it took to bring the very best artists under their wing, so that the churches built up to the time of the Reformation and after. I don't mean to say that everything fell off the edge of the abyss after the Reformation, but the Romanesque and Gothic and architecture is just absolutely stunning. I've got this in my mind now because I just returned from a month in France, and every darn little town in the country has got a church that has been standing there, built beautifully, maintained beautifully since the 12th, 13th, 14th century. It's just unbelievable that there are these places there, beautifully designed, beautiful to look at, beautiful acoustics inside. The church nowadays doesn't have that kind of power. It hasn't had it for a long time. The church hired the very finest painters to paint the frescoes. Think of Michelangelo and the Sistine Chapel. Or Fra Angelica. These people were all employed by the church. The very finest musicians of the time were almost entirely under the protection of the church, either working directly for the Pope, as Josquin did, as a singer and conductor in the Papal Chapel, as Palestrina did, as the conductor in the Sistine Chapel, or else working for very powerful princes and dukes as singer or choir master in the chapels, like the Duke of Ferrara, which Josquin did for a time. So the very, very best people, most talented, most highly skilled, most trained, most artistic, were writing for the Catholic Church. There is a tradition that we know of a more popular, simple, folky kind of music in the early Catholic Church. There were pilgrims taking trips to pilgrimage sites, both, well, one very popular place, since so many of you are of Scandinavian background, was to go up to Trondheim, to the Nidaros Cathedral up there, but also down through southern France into Spain. There were many pilgrimage sites along the way, and the pilgrims had a kind of music that they sang. There's a bunch of these that are called laude, L-A-U-D-E, and these are songs in praise of God and praise of the Virgin Mary. And they were much like the more popular, simpler kind of music that is sung in many churches today, but that was anything but mainstream. Now, how did they get away with it? Their parishioners were not, you know, the bulk of people, I mean, everybody belonged to the Catholic Church. You didn't join. you were just in it. They didn't have to please their congregations. They didn't have to write and perform music that the kids would like. They could compel with the fear of damnation. You know, the church wasn't an option to people. It was an absolute in their lives. And I think, I don't know this for sure. I'm a performer, a musician, rather than a scholar. But I suspect that there was a feeling that we have to offer the very, very best that we have to God, rather than say, I'm good enough, and this little tune or this little ditty that I can hum or sing or play on a drum or something is good enough for God because it's me. I think there was the feeling that God was awfully powerful and rather frightening, and that we have to offer the best architecture, the best art, all of our money, and the very best music to God. And maybe this wasn't good religion, but it was great for art. It was wonderful for art, and we've profited from it ever since. When the Protestant Reformation came along, and I'll speak just specifically about the Lutheran Reformation, there was a move to bring music to the people, to take it out of Latin and put it in specifically, for us Lutherans, to put it into German so that the congregation could participate in singing the hymns, could know what the words were about, could feel more intimately involved. There was a lot of this evangelical, pietistic fervor in the early Lutheran church, which we never lost. At the same time, though, as I pointed out before, Luther was just a darn good musician. He didn't just take any dumb songs and put words to them. As an example, now you pick up your red book. There's more up here in a box if you haven't got one. And I would like you to turn to page 271, or hymn 271. Notice the composer, Heinrich Isaac, died in the very year that Martin Luther posted the 95 Theses. That's one of the few dates in history that I remember. I think it's because when I was confirmed, we still had public examination on Friday night, and you had to know 1517. I've never forgotten it. Isaac, therefore, was also pre-Lutheran. Isaac was a compatriot of Josquin, the first guy I mentioned. He also came from the Netherlands. He also went down to Italy. He also wrote motets, masses, and secular songs. One of the secular songs that he wrote, which was called a Lied, just because it happened to be a secular song in the German language, was called Innsbruck, ich muss dich lassen. Innsbruck, I must leave you. Notice up here in the left-hand corner, the name of this melody is Innsbruck. It was a popular song that happened to be written by a very, very fine composer. They wrote popular songs for the courts, the very courts that they served as church musicians. They also wrote banquet music for them, or wrote music for small ensembles that would play for parties and stuff like that, and one of the pieces was Innsbruck. And Martin Luther took the melody. This was a very popular song. If it had been on the radio, it would have been top 40 for a long time. It was just, apparently everybody knew this song. Luther took it, and not necessarily himself, but the early Lutherans took this hymn, added sacred words to it, and it became one of the standard hymns of the early Lutheran church. Now, just to add a little color to this presentation, let's sing it in this harmonization. This is Isaac's original harmonization. Okay, well, the rhythm's a little different, but the harmony's right. Okay? pretty good tune. That's a popular song from the 15th century, but awfully good music, and was grabbed up by the Lutheran Church right off the bat. Now, would you turn back to number 228? This is the same melody taken up many years later by J.S. Bach, who recognized the value of this melody and took many of these tunes which were current in the Lutheran Church, popular tunes which had been adopted by the Lutherans and then adapted to worship use. He took this and harmonized it himself. So now why don't you sing the first verse of this version of it? Further remove with Bach's harmonization from the original popular song. I thought as I was playing this is a very difficult subject. You have people on all sides of it, and art is a fluid thing. Things happen that you never intend and that you never plan for, and Bach came along and he was a Lutheran, and we had something like this happen. We're very lucky. The fact is that composers who are now, right, this is parenthetical, but put great big black parentheses. I think it's very important. Composers that we have now, Marty Haugen, for instance, just take that as an example, wish very much to take the popular music of today, popular, singable music, familiar to their listeners, familiar to the parishioners, something to which they can really relate, and they want this to happen to it. We haven't seen a Bach yet in our current century, but I think that this is what they would like to have happen, that there's a sense in which for a lot of people, what the two hymns, or the one hymn and hymn sub one that we've just performed, really don't reach some of our people. And I'm personally very sorry about that, because if I could die and go to heaven and meet Bach, I'd do it tonight, you know. But the fact is, I was a public school teacher for a while, junior high and elementary, and they didn't want to hear it. They didn't want to study it. And I think that somebody like Marty Haugen is not just being very successful at selling his music. He has a goal in this. I think the church on the whole has a goal, that they know their music history, and they know that this is where our music came from. It is interesting to me in this light that the German and Scandinavian countries and their descendants in this country have got one of the most, perhaps the most significant choral tradition alive in the world today, in a very narrow sense, you know, soprano, alto, tenor, bass. Four-part singing a cappella or with organ, sometimes with orchestral accompaniment. But this is based on the German chorale tradition. Those churches didn't have organs, many of them, small churches in the country, and They could sing in four parts. They learned to do it. They were trained to do it. They liked this music, and it became a big deal. And if you go to Scandinavia, or if you have the opportunity to listen to recordings of Scandinavian choirs, they're amongst the very best in the world, the Swedish Radio Choir or the Torshov Choir in Oslo, even the choirs in Finland, and the North German choirs. They're very, very skilled, and they are, in their basis, amateur. They are people who learn to sing in the public schools and in the church choirs in those countries. When their descendants came to this country and moved to Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, so forth, and started founding colleges, they wanted their colleges to have the same kind of choirs. And now in this country, the Lutheran choirs are certainly, as a group, the most recognizable and most highly regarded body of choirs in the United States. We really have a marvelous tradition as Lutherans. We're very, very fortunate, and it's we've got to be very careful not to throw this stuff out as we tune ourselves to modern times. Because it's really good. Something like Bach does not just pass with time. It's important music. That's a value judgment that an individual makes and that all kinds of people in music history departments and universities make. And I know very well that I could be 17 and say, huh, well, that's what you say. I don't like it very much at all, and that my opinion's valid. I know, I said that too. But I hope that the church leadership, I say that because I'm a little bothered by the new, well, it's not so new, the green hymnal. They don't have very much Bach at all. They have like three. And not only do they only have three by Bach, but they've changed the harmonizations, really altered them, and they're not as good as they used to be. And that has been something that has bothered me ever since the new hymnal came out. With my choir at the University of Chicago, the chapel choir, we most Sundays will sing something from this, and that chapel is Episcopalian, but I have a bunch of these. I borrowed them from the Lutheran Church. And most Sundays we will sing a chorale out of this, because I think that this particular Red Book is a marvelous, marvelous collection of very fine music. And I hope we come back to some of it in our church.
I was going to say, you know how difficult that is for us older people who have been raised on all this good music, and now where we live in Cherokee Village, we have a choir director that deals mostly in gospel.
Yeah.
Sunday after Sunday, and she gets up the camera and up and down.
Yeah.
Your innards kind of go around.
It's
difficult.
You know, you brought up about the fact that a lot of this finds its base in the folk music revival of the 50s and 60s in this country. First of all, we had the Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and so forth, introducing acoustic guitars into mainstream youth culture. And those mainstream youths are now, you know, middle-aged, and they're calling the shots in the churches. Another part of it is the civil rights songs of that same era, which had a certain emotional immediacy. I remember that very well. I graduated from college in 1971, and it was while I was in school and while I was starting graduate school that so much was happening. And the music was very, very important to me. It was an incredibly important part of the whole civil rights and war protest movement. Without the songs, what would a protest have been? What would a march? I remember we did a march down the main street of Decorah, Iowa. If you've been there, it's very small. singing We Shall Overcome and everybody holding hands. If we hadn't had the song to sing, it would have been flat. Well, that's, once again, now people my age are calling the shots, and we remember how important that was to us, how exciting that and how immediate that music was. Another thing that's happened since that time, I mentioned before, the largest church body in the world, the Roman Catholic Church, had Vatican II. And decided to throw out basically the Latin Mass and the Gregorian chant, Now, it's not as absolute as all that, but it's pretty close. So that the Roman Catholic Church, that's a heck of a lot of people in the United States, were suddenly set loose without a congregational participatory musical tradition. So what they grabbed onto was popular music. And I can say from my own experience, because I spent a year as baritone soloist at the Cathedral of the Holy Name in Chicago, which is a heck of a big place. It's the second largest archdiocese in the country. A year before I came, they hired Richard Proulx, P-R-O-U-L-X, a name some of you may know. He's written a lot of music, and it was a sort of general editor for the GIA Publications, which publishes Marty Haugen. But he is a very fine classically trained musician and composer, organist. And Holy Name hired him and said, do something about this Vatican II stuff. Let's get some good music back into the Catholic Church. He's a Lutheran. But he went to the Catholic Church, and the year that I spent with him, he did his best to reintroduce music from the 16th and 15th centuries into the service. But as I say, the Catholics are an enormous part of our population, and when they started participating in worship music, they started at the folk music, folk mass level. Then another thing that happened, and I think this is very, very important, is that our economy has been declining. And as our economy declined, I can say this as a former public school music teacher, things that got cut were public school music programs. Now, when I was going through the Minnesota public school system, I started in first grade with music, honest to God, 5 days a week. We had 3 days with our special music teacher who came in, 2 days with our elementary teachers who had to be trained to do music in the classroom. That was part of certification for elementary teachers in Minnesota. I had the same special teacher 3 days a week from first grade through sixth grade, and then 5 days a week, 7, 8, and 9. I had a wonderful musical background. And then I would go to church. My church had a little kiddie choir, had a boys choir and girls choir, had a youth choir, and then when I was about 15, I went into the senior choir. Now, I was more interested than most, so I took more advantage of it. But the fact was, all of those opportunities were available in a suburb of Minneapolis-St. Paul. And when I went to college, to Luther College, I found that all the kids I was in college with who came from every darn small town in that five-state area, they'd all had the same thing. We had a marvelous public school music education. So we had the skills to read music, to sing it in tune, to sing in parts, and we also had been exposed to so much music that our senses had been sharpened, our tastes had been honed and refined right along. You know, we didn't know that had been happening, but indeed it had. And for a Lutheran, that was a good deal, because most of the public school music teachers in Minnesota seemed to have graduated from St. Olaf or Luther or Concordia or something, and so they brought us up through the public schools with the tradition. We were also, back then, and I will not make a value judgment about this politically, but we were allowed to sing sacred music in school. And the fact is, almost all good choral music throughout history was written for the church. You just cannot avoid it. Now composers have jumped onto this and are trying very hard to turn out good choral music with secular texts, but my personal conviction in this is, if you don't have God to write to, you're not inspired to write as good a music. I almost really believe that, because that's been my experience with the music. And now I have a brother and sister who are much younger than I am, who've just graduated from college, but they were in the same high school I went to some 18, 19 years later, and they sang trash. It was terrible, the music they were singing. Well, they weren't allowed to sing sacred music. When Christmas came, they had to sing about Frosty the Snowman and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and caroling, 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 caroling. They didn't get to do the music that we did, and maybe that's okay, but nothing replaced it of value. So I think the public schools have had a lot to do with the decline. Oh, I made a value judgment. With the change in church music for the Lutherans. I think because people just aren't prepared. They don't have the skills anymore to deal with. It just did it. That's not the common thing. We select for a pretty good group here.
Do you think that that's at least in part due to boredom more than anything else in higher education? Because there seems to be the cult of the 20th century is to have something new and different. And
certainly in junior high it is.
Well, it's not just in junior high. I mean, it's at the academic level too, especially maybe at the academic level. That's why you get such unlistenable things produced.
Yeah, it is interesting. I think I know what you mean.
You have to talk your way into being interested in it. It's to be talked about more than it is to be listened to with much of 20th century music. And part of that, I think, is, I think it was Bertrand Russell who said the sin of the 20th century is boredom, the great sin of the 20th century is boredom. And I think that seems to be true.
There is certainly an immense split between music which is written to be sold and performed in the schools and churches, and music which is supposed to be great. The university that I teach at, University of Chicago, has got a big, well, not large, but very deep composition department. And we have Shulamit Ron, who's a Pulitzer Prize winner, and John Eaton, who's a very famous composer of opera and vocal music, and we have Ralph Shapey, who's a MacArthur Fellow, and these in the very rarefied world of modern music composition, these are three real big names, and I hear a lot of their music. And I can say it has really nothing to do with performance by you and me. It is written to be performed by a small group of people who have the skills to perform it and to be listened to knowledgeably by an equally small group of people. And then once it has been rehearsed and performed at great expense, it's put in a file cabinet. Maybe it gets recorded, and so somebody listens to it a couple of times that way, but it's too expensive and difficult to produce very often.
It's inaccessible by nature.
Yeah.
So it deserves to be in a file cabinet. It's meant to be inaccessible.
And it's a shame, because at the same time that the general musical skills of the public are going down and kind of being replaced by listening to other people do music, which that's a bugaboo of mine. I think 20th century, that's a terrible thing. That instead, we don't do music anymore, we buy other people's music. And my wife and I don't own a TV or a CD player. I think it's that's not. I mean, it's important to me that you live on your own instead of just living in the reflection of what other people are doing and then paying your money for it. It that bothers me, and I do think it's had a really detrimental effect on people's ability to make their own music and therefore to understand what goes in to making music and to be able to listen to other people's music.
Much music written for a cappella. Most of what I've seen always has organ or piano accompaniment.
Yeah, you know, the publishing houses, automatically, you're a university, you're on a mailing list, and I get promotional packets all the time, and very little now is a cappella.
And I don't think there's anything as beautiful as a choir that sings a cappella.
A friend of mine, a friend of mine named Alex George is on the editorial staff at Augsburg Publishing, and music editorial staff, and I've talked with her at some length about this, and she said, frankly, we can't sell that stuff. People won't buy it. It's too difficult for their choirs, and the composers just are frustrated. So what we can sell is two-part or unison or SAB with the parts, simple, very few chord changes with very supportive accompaniment, but not difficult accompaniment, just supportive, but something that sounds popular but is not hard, because chances are your keyboard person's skills aren't all that high level either. I mean, that is an economic fact for Augsburg Publishing, for them, that's what they can sell. This split between the serious composers and what we can really accomplish bothers me a great deal. It really does.
There's a lot to these of mutual reinforcement there, though. There's nothing quite like singing it to make you appreciate Bach choral music, or playing it, or whatever. So you end up cycling your way out of it entirely. And I guess the real problem and challenge is to get the cycle turned back.
Yeah, I agree.
But that takes a number of different items.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm someone like perhaps the rest of you who's grown up singing a lot of hymns from 6 years on, even zero on. And in my mind, they've fallen into a hierarchy of sort of boredom. And the best ones are the Welsh, I think, or some of the Norwegian, who've got tunes that really will carry the day and they'll survive the ravages of time, like the Rock of Ages. And then you go down the list, and down the bottom are the German, last is the British, and right now we're, in my opinion, we're worshiping in an Anglican church with something that must be the Book of Common Prayer still. And it strikes me, as I sit there with my four-year-old daughter, how nothing else in our lives is as old as those hymns that we sing. And they're ready for the grave. They should be there a long time ago. They even have tunes that we gave up 200 years ago in the Anglican hymn book. And so from that point of view, you look for where is the new hymn. And we have some. They don't have very many new ones, except in supplementary soft cover, staple things. But just that as a sort of a comment saying from the pew by somebody who doesn't know much about music, that the place seems ripe for new sacred music. Yeah. And I wonder if you could just say a bit about the development. Is it true that our hymns are all that old, or have they been developing right along? I mean, you look at the dates.
Yeah, you know what? We have a certain body in our hymnal of the traditional Lutheran hymns that come from Scandinavia and Germany. But then we do have a tremendous number of 18th and 19th century English hymns, some of them written in this country as part of the Great Awakening. The New Green Hymnal has a number of hymns that come from the Sacred Harp tradition of the Appalachians. But to some extent, because the Lutherans came to the United States and learned English, then they had to have a body of hymns written in English. And some of the best loved ones from the old country were translated into English, but an awful lot of what we sing we picked up as Lutherans because it was in English. I think that's kind of humorous sometimes, because we sing an awful lot of, they're passing out now, but Onward Christian Soldiers. We sing all kinds of hymns that are celebrations of British imperialism. It came right from England and have absolutely nothing to do with our faith or our tradition. They just happen to be written in English.
But they got cut in the Green Hymnal.
Yeah, they were cut in the Green Hymnal, that's right. And that is a really significant positive change. I agree, yeah.
Well, the hymnal 1982 of the Episcopal Church is full of contemporary music.
Yeah, these are British Anglicans.
Oh, I'm sorry. In the United
We're
States,
overseas.
The hymnal is full of new music, but of course some churches don't do them. But I did want to mention the experience at St. Mark's Episcopal Cathedral in Seattle.
Right, and it's famous for that.
And the church is full of young people sitting on the floor because there's no room in the pews. It's basically the English monastic service of Benedictine monastery there. But there's a lot of contemporary music as well as
Yeah. You have segued right into my next point. As I said before, I direct the student choirs at the University of Chicago. The school is a very scholarly institution, and my students are real bright. And those who want to come out to sing in my choirs want to sing very fine music. And I don't want at all to imply that I think that young people are not interested in art music anymore. It's not true. My students, one of my choirs is called Motet Choir. We sing motets. A motet is basically an unaccompanied piece of music with sacred words, not too long, but probably pretty difficult. My students require that I program this music for them. It's what they want to sing. The thing about that is that they're not singing that as an expression of faith. They're singing that because they're interested in art. They love good music, and they've been brought up to love good music, and it's an aesthetic, and for some of them, a academic experience for them to sing this fine music and to get to know it. And I'm all for that. I hope that my students graduate, go out, have children, pay taxes, and put a lot of money into music education because of the experience that they've had with me and with other choirs. It's just that there's a very strong feeling amongst religious people, I believe. You can speak to this yourselves, that sometimes art gets in the way of faith. That if you're concentrating on something being excellent, something being high level, that becomes your focus rather than what it does for your spiritual life. And I know that I have a couple of students. I teach at a very secular school, I should add, right away. I mean, very few of my students profess religious faith. But I have a couple who do, who love to sing art music in choir, and then they go to whatever churches they go to, where they sing an entirely different kind of music, and to them the split, they're aware of it, they think about it, but it doesn't trouble them. They think that it's a different kind of music that they should do for religion. Any comments to that?
Are you a member of the ADO,
Martin? No, I'm not. I'm not an organist. I'm just a singer.
There seems to be a terrific slide in the church musician. I guess about 10 years ago, the AGO in Washington sent out a warning to all the denominations that if something was not done to enhance the status of the church musician, that is the organist, by the year 2000...
There wouldn't be organists.
What I mean, organists, not people that think they can play the organ.
No.
There would be no more organists. So an effort now is being made to try and
pull
that out, but it's difficult.
It is. It costs a lot of money to support a good organist in your church and to support an instrument for him to play and to support a choir for him to conduct. And the church has got to believe from the ground up that this is where they want to put their resources. And if they feel that this does not reflect their faith, that this is an aesthetic expression which is all very fine if you got lots of money, but what does it have to do with my salvation or with feeding the poor, then the church music program goes. Yeah.
Yeah, organists used to be so highly thought of in the old churches in Europe, there's a plaque at the entrance that has a list of all the organists.
Yeah.
The church was built. And
yeah.
For many, many years.
Yeah, that's really very true. Yeah. So did my mom. Yeah.
And we sang that a cappella.
Yeah.
And we went just to sing at different places.
Yes. And that was a... Yeah. And that was a... At West High, they had a very... Because Tkach was a really, really big guy in choral music.
First class every day.
Yeah.
And he also... also directed an Igloolugan church downtown.
Yeah.
As a new teacher in the state of Washington, I can say that it does vary from district to district. Some districts allow no religious music in all. Some are half, some are down to a third. That's where we are right now. And it does change, but I grew up in the Lutheran tradition. That's not mine at all. Our choir director in high school was from St. Olaf. I got that old.
Yeah.
It's always been part of my life, and I came from a wonderful heritage.
Yeah.
But I very definitely, from an outsider, can say the same thing about some of these Yankan traditions. And I know that it's been a real issue with particularly the high school choral conductors, because they say you're wiping out 75% of our music. Really? And in our district, I'm in the Kent School District, they're still allowed a percentage. But it is really a problem.
Oh, yeah. The president of my university is famous for being really ill-tempered, and her background is Jewish, but she is a non-practicing Jew, and I have to perform choral music for convocations, that is big, usually graduations, and they happen. I have a minimum of 6 convocations per year for which I am supposed to present really classy stuff, you know, to impress the 1,200 people gathered downstairs and so forth. But if she perceives the word Domine or Deus or Jesu Christe or anything like that, if she hears it, I'll get in trouble. It's really a trick. I finally last August I did the Randall Thompson Alleluia, because it's only got one word in the whole darn thing. And then somebody told me afterwards, yes, but she thought it sounded religious. You just can't win.
Yeah. I was all the time one time met a small junior high school kid, highly trained. They ran a Christmas program in connection with the Arts Council exhibits and stuff like this. So they sat down there. Marvelous piano, violin, cello, combination like this. They were playing Frosty the Snowman and all that stuff like that because somehow they felt that the music, without any words, was too religious. So yeah. For Christmas, you could not sing, you could not play religious music.
Because everybody knew what the words would be.
And I thought that's sort of the acne. I mean, to see these skilled musicians playing stuff that was obviously maybe I can't play at all, so it's level right above that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with you really about the schools and the loss of the specialist music and so on. And they're, in addition, they're also being flooded with the multicultural push that
we've got.
Traditions and exposing children to many of the experiences, which I believe is supporting it.
Yeah.
To support the church musician or to support community things in addition to the schools that are going to keep these specialized traditions alive. We can't expect that we can do everything and keep it all and yet expose everybody to all the things that are at disposal.
Yeah. Multiculturalism is a very big issue in this. When they had the installation at the beginning of the ELCA in Chicago, and they had a collection of musical performances as part of that, trying to reflect the many, many facets of the new church. And it was bewildering how many things that are now come under the umbrella of Lutheran, much less under the umbrella of Christian. I finally, in my school choirs, I finally had to just say, I'm narrow, and my focus is narrow because I've only got so much time in the day, and we have to do something very well. So we are going to do music of Northwest Europe. That's the way it is. But in saying that, I have in my choirs are about a third Jewish, maybe a third Asian, many of whom are not Christian. I occasionally get blacks, although not very many. They tend not to go to the University of Chicago. But I sometimes do. And yet these students, if I try, I used to try this more frequently to program something that would be a bend in that direction. They get really angry. Honestly, my students, and my students are happy to get publicly angry about the fact that I'm stooping to political correctness by programming a spiritual, or by programming a Jewish piece, or by programming something with a secular text by a modern poet or something. They say, this doesn't have basically the artistic quality of the music we want to do, so why are you foisting this upon us? Sometimes I really, you know, our alumni audiences, when we go on tour, would love to hear some of this music, but my students won't sing it. And so I feel in a quandary, because I have some of these same people in my chapel choir on Sunday. They want to sing the same music on Sunday. And so our church, which follows the Book of Common Prayer, and I sing this stuff in the loft, has a moribund congregation. And if I were, it doesn't start with me, it starts with the leadership of this particular chapel, but if they were to make an attempt to make that place come alive, to really be a house of faith, to really minister to our university and to the south side of Chicago, it would be a revolution. The place would just completely overturn everything. I'm sure I would lose my job, and I'm not saying that I shouldn't. Something else should happen there. We're a museum. We really are. Museum with an endowment from John D. Rockefeller to support our maintenance. That's another parenthetical. We got time for a couple more comments before we get in line. Anybody have anything to say?
Yeah.
In a minute? Did I see another hand? Yeah.
Some years ago, there was a small nucleus of people who tried to discredit Bach's faith. You know, we look on Johann Sebastian Bach as the giant of faith, and so on and so forth. And they enumerated that, well, in his failing years, he didn't propose any more religious music. And of course, I guess these men have been put to silence. Have you ever heard anything about such things?
Bach wrote what he had to satisfy the people that hired him. that was, every musician puts up with that. I, as a singer, have sung in synagogues, and have sung in Catholic churches, Episcopal churches, Presbyterian churches, Lutheran churches, and that's the life of a musician. You know, we're not allowed to have convictions except is it good or not. we do what we're called on to do. Well, I guess we better go eat. They rang it a little early. We don't want the food to get cold. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.